And welcome to another special edition of Anti-Psychiatry Radio Friends and Allies and Activists. This is your proud anti-psychiatry host, Don Weitz, with the August 27th, 2010 edition of Anti-Psychiatry Radio. The only one of its kind, only anti-psychiatry program in Canada, I may add. And tonight is special because with me is a good friend, ally, colleague, Professor Jeffrey Rayom, and we will be talking about exploitation, economic exploitation of psychiatric patients at what used to be called the Lunatic Asylum of Toronto, or the Toronto Lunatic Asylum, now known as CAMH, Center for Addiction and Mental Health. So Professor Rayom is professor at York University with the Critical Disability Studies, and he's been there for several years and pioneered the course on Mad People's History, both at Ryerson and at York University. And Jeffrey Rayom, Professor Rayom, is also the co-founder of the Psychiatric Survivor Archives of Toronto, the only archives for psychiatric survivor materials in Canada and probably in North America. Welcome to Anti-Psychiatry Radio, CKLN, Jeff.
Great. Well, thanks, Don. I'm very delighted to be here and to be interviewed by the great Don Weitz, especially. I know Don won't like that, but don't worry, readers.
Maybe we can edit out great, but that's fine.
But Don is, just so you know, Don is also a co-founder of the Psychiatric Survivor Archives, too.
Well,
so I'm in good company, Don, Mel, Starkman, me.
Well, thanks,
and Janet Brooks, and many other people since then.
That's right. Co-founder
almost
with Mel Starkman and our good friend.
Janet Brooks.
And
almost 10 years ago, January of 2001.
Yes. So tonight, Jeff, I thought it would be good for people to know, because many of our listeners do not know about the serious exploitation of psychiatric patients. They know about the drugging and blah, and incarceration. Mm-hmm. But you have a historical, you as an historian, a scholar, you have documented exploitation of many psychiatric patients and written a book, of course, which we'll get into if... Yes, I should add that Professor Rayom is the author of Remembrance of Patients Past, the Toronto Lunatic Asylum, 1870 to 1940. I should know, I read it.
Yeah.
Okay, Jeff, so please, it's all yours. Could give us some here perspective and as much detail as you want about the economic exploitation at CAMH.
Okay, thanks, Don. So, yes, I'll talk about it beginning in the late 1800s, the mid to late 1800s, and glad to bring it up to more recent times. Yes, the exploitation of patient laborers, psychiatric patient laborers, began right when the building was open, 1850. There was, in fact, patients were working from the early 1850s there. The pipes were disconnected, and a huge cesspool of sewage and kitchen slops and everything gathered beneath the basement that was 4 to 6 feet in depth, and it was a huge area during the first 3 years of the asylum's history, 1850 to 53. And who did they have clean it up? Male patient laborers in 1853 under the supervision of Joseph Workman.
Which they named the auditorium still standing
after him. And that's right. So I'm not an admirer of Joseph Workman. He was an exploiter of patient labor. And, of course, this cesspool had to be cleaned up, needless to say, but it should have been cleaned up by people who were properly paid to do the work. And patients weren't. They weren't paid anything. And a workman did write a report about it some years later, and he alluded rather vaguely to people getting sick while doing it. Surprise, surprise, but we don't know the details, of course, because that wasn't recorded. quoted outside of a brief reference in his article. But that gives an idea of how our the labor of those people who have been in psychiatric institutions has been exploited so much. Yes. And of course, the biggest representation of that is the wall that still exists at Queen Street, that still exists today, is the patient-built boundary walls along the east, west, and south side of Queen Street. Mm-hmm. That were built and rebuilt by male patient laborers on the east and west side, 1888-89, and on the south and north side, those were built in 1860.
And none of them was paid. Not one patient was paid for doing this bricklaying, sweaty work, right?
That's right. Originally, the whole wall was built in 1860, I should say, on the all four sides, but it had to be moved in 1888-89, the east-west sides, because they sold out property. But absolutely right, Don. No one was paid a penny, neither male nor females. Males built the existing boundary walls that still exist. Females did a huge amount of work in the laundry, sewing, domestic servants, kitchen work. So they were put to great exploitation as well of their labor, as were male patients doing maintenance work, building things around the asylum, agricultural work, things like that, coal gang. So patient laborers were hugely exploited. And of course, the poorer you were, the more work you're expected to do. At Queen Street 100 years ago, for example, there was 1,200 patients, 600 men and 600 women. And over two-thirds of those patients were public patients, meaning they had absolutely nobody to support them as private patients. Remember, this was pre-OHIP days. And the patients who worked there, they would have been, the vast majority were patients who had no, their families either had no money to be able to buy them get them private or semi-private rooms. That was a very small minority who had that back then. So they were on overcrowded wards. And the poorer you were, if you had a family who couldn't support you, or you had no family at all, sometimes people were just abandoned there. And therefore, they had nobody in the world to give to be supportive. Lots of people like that. And then they were expected to work. That was very clear in the that. And so they had, the poorer you were, the more work.
So there was. I wondered what proportion, if you, as far as you know, were poor.
Two-thirds.
What proportion of the patients?
About just under 70%.
70%.
So it's about 67, 68%, just
still,
over two-thirds.
Sorry. And today, most of the people ending up at Green Street and
right.
Now CAMH, right, are also quite
yes.
poor, aren't they?
I don't have the statistics on it, but yes, certainly people I've known there,
yeah.
and of course people I know about, that generally speaking at the Queen Street site, a lot of poor people,
mm-hmm.
of course, who are patients there. Absolutely, there's no question about that. So, of course, poverty has a lot to do with people,
mm-hmm.
Past and present, ending up in the psychiatric hospital.
Right. Also in regular prison, right?
Exactly. You don't see rich people.
You don't see rich.
Very seldom. Or if they do, Conrad Black, he gets out early.
He gets special treatment while he's in.
Exactly. I mean, the rich, even if they do end up in jail, they get the, you know, the best treatment possible.
Exactly.
And they get out early.
So can you give us, Jeff, a few more examples through a timeline, so to speak, late 19th century, say, based, of course, on your book, on the research you did for your book, The Remembrance of Patients Past, which I strongly recommend our listeners to read. It's outstanding history.
Oh, well, thank you.
Personal, you get into the details and very moving and gripping personal stories of suffering of people and how they were exploited there at the lunatic asylum in Toronto, as it was called. So maybe a few more examples, if you don't mind, that come to mind.
Absolutely. Well, one person, for example, Audrey B. Audrey was a woman who was in Queen Street from 1905 to 1946. She was there for the last 41 years of her life.
41 years.
41 years, exactly. Mm-hmm. And for at least 30 of those years, I was able to trace this in her clinical records. Audrey worked in the sewing room, and she did enormous amounts of work, and she was specifically complimented in her clinical records as being an expert seamstress, What did she do? She sewed all the underwear of the asylum for the asylum. So it saved them huge amounts of money. They didn't have to pay for that.
How much money do you think she saved them?
Well, to be honest, I couldn't calculate. I'm afraid I don't know.
No, but
certainly in the thousands of dollars.
Many thousands.
Well, I do have actually a calculation for the walls.
Yeah.
In the words of the superintendent, I can't give it for Audrey, I'm sorry to say,
but
certainly she would have saved them a lot of money over 30 years, thousands of dollars, no question about it, by the fact that she never was paid for her work. And she was repeatedly complimented as an expert seamstress. For the walls, Daniel Clark wrote in 1888-89, when they rebuilt the walls, he said that having the patients do that work saved public works, quote, tens of thousands of dollars.
Probably an underestimate.
Indeed, but you can imagine tens of thousands of dollars in 1888-89. We can multiply that quite a bit today. So that's pretty darn a lot of money.
Daniel Clark was the superintendent.
That's right. Daniel Clark was superintendent 1875 to 1905.
You're right.
Not to be confused with his successor, C.K. Clark, who was a disgraceful doctor who was very prejudiced towards people who weren't white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. And
he was a bigot.
He was a bigot. He was anti-Semitic. He was a racist towards blacks, people Afro-Canadian, Afro-Caribbean background, towards Asians. He deported an Asian man named Lee F. in 1907 who had been very depressed. He was isolated in Toronto and was confined here in 1905. And then in 1907 he deported him all the way to China.
Jeez.
And the man was hardly in any position to travel. He was not.
That's
in good
a very cruel thing.
Very cruel. And why did he deport him? Because he was Asian. And he didn't care what happened to him. So
there's still racism still going on, isn't there?
Oh, of course.
In the system, although that's a whole subject, a special show, program in itself.
Yes, but of
the
course.
Racism in psychiatry.
Yeah. Yes, Suman Fernando has written about some of the prejudices, like, for example, males of Afro-Caribbean background in Britain. He wrote about how they were excessively diagnosed with schizophrenia in the 1990s in Britain. Suman Fernando has written.
Like a circle in a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel, never ending or beginning, on an ever spinning wheel, like a snowball down a mountain or a carnival balloon, like a carousel that's turning, running rings around the moon, like a clock whose hands are sweeping past the minutes of its face, and the world is like an apple whirling silently in space, like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind, like a tunnel that you follow to a tunnel of its own, down a hollow to a cavern where the sun has never shone, like a door that keeps revolving in a half-forgotten dream, or the ripples from a pebble someone tosses in a stream, like a clock whose hands are sweeping past the of its face, and the world is like an apple whirling silently in space, like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind.
So, still on our theme, of course, of the show of exploitation, say in 19 during the war years, say, or we're going or 20 to 1930, going up to World War One, maybe up to World War Two. Are there any particular examples that stand out?
Yes, very much.
That you want to mention?
Yes, definitely.
Of exploitation.
Yes, for sure. There was also other people who worked in the asylum and in the laundry during the interwar period. Sandra T. was one person. She was an African-Canadian woman who worked in the laundry for many years until she had to... She wasn't able to work after a while because she got cataracts in her eyes. And they didn't remove the cataracts, so she became blind. And so she worked in the laundry for a long period of time. There were others who also did a huge amount of work. Winston O.
Winston, right?
Yes, he was a male patient who was a cooper. A cooper was, of course, a man who made barrels. He was confined from 1877 till his death in 1934. He was almost 90. And into the well into his 70s and 80s, into the 1920s, right a few years before he died in 1934, he was doing all kinds of work, including chopping down trees or supervising chopping down trees. And he did all sorts of maintenance work around the asylum as well.
Yes.
And he also, mind you, supported his fellow patients with his labor. He made a violin that he found out of a box and played it for his fellow patients on a locked ward. So
he made it and then played for it, even though he's not known as a musician, or wasn't known as a musician.
No,
he had
that was the only reference in the whole clinical record to
it. Maybe he taught himself.
Yeah, he could have. Maybe, or maybe he did it on his own. But yeah, he was a man of many talents, but that's another of many examples. And there's quite a few pages. There was Elaine O, who did a great deal of work in the asylum laundry as well. And Mary A. Mary had worked in the asylum laundry up till 1911 when she was discharged for 17 years. And then after she was discharged, her husband took her home. Mm-hmm. He insisted. They didn't want to release her, but he took her home.
And patriarchy.
Yes.
The man having control over
Yes, that's right.
His wife.
But in this case, it was good.
Anyway.
He did advocate for her to come home. So she
live
at home.
Oh, well, that's good. At least he got her out.
Yes, it was certainly patriarchal. I'm not pretending otherwise. But having said that, he did get her out. And she stayed at home for the rest of her life. And he was a postal clerk. He was a working class man. He delivered the mail. And then he retired. Mm-hmm. And Mary wrote a letter demanding to be paid for her work in 1922.
Good for
and
her.
She
that
actually,
must have taken a lot of
yes, it did. Oh, she wrote it, and she wrote it to her former doctor, Harvey Clare, who by then was superintendent in 1922 of the asylum, and she demanded to get paid. She said for her 17 years imprisonment, and that's her word, imprisonment, that she should get paid 1,000, and I just read it a short while ago at the Wall Tour. She should get paid $1,248, $3 a week, she calculated, for her 17 years in prison.
$3 a week.
And she demanded to be paid. And she said, my husband is now retired, who was a postal clerk, and they need every cent they could get. They were a working class family, or husband and wife.
Sure.
They had some kids, but the children were married by this time and living away, but they needed all the money they could get. And, of course, they got nothing. She got no compensation for her labor, and she died a few months later.
What was it? Now, she wrote to the superintendent? Was that Clark?
No, in 1922, it was Harvey Clare. He had been her personal doctor, her ward doctor, in the early 1900s till her discharge in 1911.
Yes.
And she wrote to him in 1922. He was then the superintendent. But she demanded to be paid by him, and she said, you know where to get your pay, basically. Why am I going to get mine? Well, she never got any pay. So
did she get a response in writing?
She did, and that was unusual because very often they just ignored their letters. I think in this case, Claire responded because her husband was also in touch with him. So I think that there was that sort of support, too.
Yeah.
Often they would just totally ignore a patient, or at least in the file, there's no response. But in this case, he
still
did.
ignoring people.
But his response was quite patronizing. He basically said to her, oh, don't worry, you've done enough work in your life. Just don't worry about it. Kind of patting her on the head in a very condescending way. And poor Mary died just a few months after she wrote that letter.
How old was she when she died?
I can't remember the exact age, but she would have been in her 60s or early 70s.
Now, there were a lot of deaths, weren't there?
Oh, yes, very much so.
At that time and since. What would you... Were any, it's probably a stupid question, but I have to ask it, were any investigated?
Actually, now that you mention it.
Deaths inside.
Yes, there were a few. There was a man who was, I think it was 1878, if I remember. And basically what they did an investigation because the man had died, he had cracked ribs.
Hmm.
And he was known as a, quote, resistant patient, or a recalcitrant patient.
Fighting back.
Exactly. And they found that, they said that the he died when the staff had restrained him, and that that's how he died, and that he restrained because he, in basically, they basically blamed him for his own death. And no one
just
was responsible.
Doing today.
And if you read between the lines of that report, it was clear he was beaten to death. They didn't say that, but it was. It didn't take much imagination to figure out how would the guy get. I mean, how do you get cracked ribs?
No.
I mean, unless somebody's hitting you in the ribs, you're not gonna, unless you're throwing yourself against the wall, which I. There's no record of this man doing it, but they got away with it. So there was that case, and then there was also a case in 1917, World War One. You're asking about World War One. A woman who was visiting her husband saw a patient who was dressed as a soldier badly handled, thrown into a room while she was visiting her husband. Then her husband died about a month later, and that was investigated because she went to the press. First she went to the administration, they ignored her, and she went to the news media and said, well, look, this soldier, she saw a soldier being abused. And so, of course, being in war, they didn't want to have a scandal. And then they had an investigation, but basically they dismissed her account and they supported the staff.
Right.
So so they tended to, of course, you know of an important case, Aldo Alviani in 1980.
Much later, yes, of course.
But earlier, the earlier
in 1980s, in the early 1980s. But can you, okay, so there was, you know, there was some investigation, but not much. Probably it sounds like a cover-up.
Absolutely,
now,
I agree with you.
Now, about more exploitation, say, okay, around, say, we're up to maybe the First World War and since, and you already know, I maybe we can get into some from the industrial therapy.
Oh, yes.
And or perhaps the Sally Ann, the Salvation Army.
Excellent
which
point.
You know about that case.
Excellent
but,
point,
Perhaps you want to maybe make some comment
Absolutely.
On that.
Well, yes, thanks for raising that. Yes, what you've mentioned on IT or industrial therapy, I mean, to be frank, I worked in IT when I was in St. Thomas Psychiatric Hospital and in a sheltered workshop. So, these places were set up after deinstitutionalization either as workshops within a hospital like IT, industrial therapy, or outside in the community, like Sally Ann, Salvation Army, and Goodwill Industries had sheltered workshops, and other places like ARC, which used to be called Association of Retarded Children, which is a terrible title.
Retarded Children.
That was the original name. Now it's Community Living, thank God. They don't have this terrible stigmatizing name. So lots of people with both psychiatric histories and people labeled mentally retarded, quite a terrible label, have been terribly exploited in these places.
Would be called handicapped today, or rather disabled.
Developmentally disabled. Lots of people were economically taken advantage of in a lot of these places. And to give you an example, Christine Kazuba in 1979-80 worked at the Salvation Army here. She got paid 50 cents an hour for her work.
50 cents an hour, and
that's
I remember
right.
that. Some were paid, 25 cents?
The lowest paid...
hospital control.
Actually, I found in Kazuba's case, actually Christine Kazuba, who fought it and lost at the Ontario Labour Relations Board
terrible,
in 1983, the ruling came down. She lost, even though it was very clear by the ARCH, Advocacy Resource Centre for the Handicap, took up her case and argued it. And they pointed out I can't remember the exact percentage, but her rate of pay would have gone up from like $1,700 from what she was paid over a year for the very low wage to about $7,000 if she was paid at the minimum wage. But because people in sheltered workshops are considered under rehabilitation and retraining, they're exempt from minimum wage laws. So they're exploited very much so.
Exactly, they're exploited.
And people with a psych history have been exploited so badly, but people with developmental disabilities horribly exploited. The same time Christina Kazuba was paid 50 cents a week, another young woman was paid...
And this was in the 80s, right?
1980.
50 cents an hour or 50 cents a week, but sometimes...
50 cents a week was what the young woman, Isabel, her name was 50 cents a week.
Horrible.
And of course, this young woman was never educated or informed of the value of her work, and her mother ended up advocating for her. And there was a wonderful quote, well, I should say a wonderful quote, a poignant quote would be a better way of putting it, getting across how awful this was. She said, what could her daughter get for 50 cents a week? Maybe an ice cream cone. Of course, that was in 1980. We couldn't get that now. You know what they did after her protest? They raised Isabel's salary from 50 cents a week to 55 cents a week. And her mother said, what an insult.
I would have thrown it back in their faces.
Oh, that's awful.
Imagine that, 2 cents, for God's sake, a week. It's
disgraceful. And this poor woman was totally, so many people with totally exploited. And so it's so, and I, if I may, there's something that Don Weitz would know. I would like to, a comrade and friend of ours, Lucy Costa, sent this to me.
Well, Lucy Costa,
she found it in the archives and sent this to me just recently. So thanks, Lucy, if you're listening, for providing it. A 1986, February 13, 1986 submission on a brief on Bill 7, a brief to amend on a certain Ontario statute to conform to Section 15 of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedom, submitted by On Our Own, of which Don Weitz was a founding member and radical activist.
I can't take credit for all that, but it was a collective submission, right? I think it was.
And Don was one of the great radicals of that group. Well, and thanks to Lucy for discovering and sending this.
Thank you, Lucy, for this.
Yes.
And I totally forgot about
it. And I would like to quote, there's a number of quotes, but what I think I would like to quote is Recommendation 12 states that any person performing work in any sheltered workshop, industrial therapy, or rehabilitation program in Ontario be not paid not less than the minimum wage.
Okay, I think, so we have that.
Yes, okay. Very much so.
Jeff, I think we're going to wind up soon.
Sure,
wind up, we are, mark our
first rate. Yes, we don't want to
exploit the technician here. We have a little time left. So, to wind up, today you gave another tour of the infamous, used to be the lunatic,
of the wall.
Go ahead.
I just want to make it clear. I always give the wall the tours outside. They never go inside to respect the privacy of people who are patients at Queen Street. Never go inside.
For our listeners should know that you have given many tours. I believe you told me today 83.
This is
can you imagine 83 tours, the walking tours of the history of this exploitation. Can you just, in the time we have, I understand an important event is coming up.
You're right.
About to memorialize, remember the brothers and sisters who have been exploited. Can you just, in the time we have just a minute or less, tell us about that. I understand it's coming up in special plaque.
That's right. Unveiling ceremony.
The plaque unveiling. Can you just tell us briefly about that coming up?
Yes, please. Yep.
On September 25th.
Psychiatric Survivor Archives, in collaboration with CAMH Archives, and CAMH was supported this, I'm glad to say, has also now have plaques that will be put up at Queen Street, and the unveiling ceremony through the work of psych survivors and advocates and allies in our community will be going up Saturday, September 25th at 1 p.m. So please, everybody's welcome, and go to it's be at the corner of Queen and Shaw.
Right.
So Queen and Shaw, East Wall, Southwest Corner. And there will be a series of 9 plaques that PSAT and our supporters and allies have been supporting and working on over the last better part of the past decade.
Several years.
More than several years.
Ten years. Jeff has led this struggle to memorialize the brothers and sisters who died. Otherwise, they've been totally forgotten.
Yes.
So I urge people to come out again.
Right.
1 p.m., September 25th,
that's
Shaw
right.
and Queen.
Exactly.
People. I want to thank you,
oh,
Jeff,
you're welcome.
For so much for taking the time.
You're
and I'm
Very
sure
glad.
That this you will have more to say and write in
Absolutely.
The future. So once again, I'm signing
thanks,
off. The Don Weitz on for Anti-Psychiatry Radio. Special thanks once again to Mark, our technician, and also I'll be back in 2 weeks. So thank you, and
thank
stand
you,
up for
too.
Your rights.
Okay, thanks, Don.